Governor Scott Walker put pen to paper Tuesday, and he signed 64 bills into law. We're going to get up to speed on some of the higher profile pieces of legislation and what those new laws mean. And later this hour, we'll explore the bills that relate specifically to agriculture. That's the plan here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in J.R. Ross now. He's editor of WispPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back.
How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. Before we test you on the dozens of bills, you didn't know you were in for a test, JR. Just kidding. Let's start out with the state Supreme Court election. After Judge Rebecca Dallet won the seat by more than 11 points, Governor Walker tweeted that we're at a risk of a blue wave here in Wisconsin, and he sent out a number of other tweets warning that Republicans are at risk of losing elections. What do you make of those tweets, and is the governor really worried here?
Yes. The short answer is yes. He is worried because after the special election in the 10th Senate District in January that Democrats won, he tweeted about a wake-up call. That wake-up call was not answered on Tuesday. Now, there's one caveat you have to add to a Supreme Court race and how it kind of projects out to November. It's not a direct correlation. Go back and look at 2007. Conservative Annette Ziegler won an open seat in the court right in between two Democratic wave elections. 2008, Michael Gavin, another conservative, knocked off incumbent Justice Butler. In April that November, Barack Obama led the biggest blue wave I've ever seen in Wisconsin. That said, this is another talking point for Democrats about what's happening in Wisconsin, about the enthusiasm that they have, and conservatives don't right now. So for them, it's part of the case. Now, we also have special elections in June for two open Republican-held seats, or had been Republican-held seats. That would be another opportunity to kind of keep building the case. And at some point, like people like to say in this business, perception becomes reality. And if you keep having these data points of things going well for Democrats, then come November, you could likely see a blue wave coming.
To what extent, then, is Governor Walker's display of these messages a rallying call for Republicans? And is that a starting point, or is that, hey, we need to build on the things that we've been doing? Where does he go with these tweets? How do they move the needle?
Good question. He's very much trying to rally his base, trying to get them excited and motivated, because I've heard anecdotally there is some, you know, lack of enthusiasm for the governor among conservatives now. Again, it's anecdotally. That's from people talking to people who are doing doors during the spring election to see, get people turned out for this fall. But there could be a couple things going on. Remember, Governor Walker governed very much like a conservative, quite conservative at times, the first 6 years he was in office. This past budget, he really focused on spending more money on schools, health care, you know, things that aren't traditionally been kind of Republican causes. So there's some question out there. Those moves should be designed to shore up vulnerabilities that he had. Obviously, Democrats have hit Governor Walker pretty much every election on funding for K-12 education. He seemed to be addressing that vulnerability with his budget. But in spending that much money, he talks about historic investment in education, does that excite conservatives? Does that make them feel like they're continuing the path that they were on because you're talking about spending more money? He may be trying to rally his base and get people excited after reaching out to the middle. And there comes the question. Is the conservative base excited about Scott Walker right now after the last year and what they've seen from him financially?
Speaking of financially, going back to the Supreme Court election, so much outside money, millions of dollars thrown into this race, partisan politics going into what is supposed to be a nonpartisan job. What do you make of all of that, of all of the outside money that went into this? And is this a turning point for elections in the future?
This has been kind of going on for about a decade now. I've been covering the Capitol for about 18 years, and Supreme Court races have changed dramatically over that time. When I first got up here, they were fairly quiet affairs. We actually had elections, a couple in a row, I believe, where we had incumbent justices who weren't even challenged. Now, we had Annette Ziegler last year who wasn't challenged, but that's become a rarity. We've also seen outside groups get more involved in these things. So this is kind of another data point in that case of we are now at a point in Wisconsin where these nonpartisan races are being run by very partisan people and drawing very partisan money. The one thing I hadn't really seen before was the State Republican Party of Wisconsin put in, by my last count, about $410,000 or so in direct support for Michael Skrenik. That was things like mail pieces, staff, those kind of expenses through what we call in-kind contributions. Usually, you know, the Republican Party has been involved in these campaigns, but not to that extent. The Democratic Party didn't have any direct contributions to Rebecca Dallet, but the party still used a turnout operation to try and get voters ginned up to turn out on Tuesday, and they weren't directly helping Dallet. They were kind of more of a general turnout operation, so you don't see a direct contribution. But they used this as a trial run for November. They have a thing called the coordinated campaign that involves the party and its candidates. They fired that up. So we're seeing more partisan help and more partisan influence in these races.
J.R. Ross is with us. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234 as we turn to a conversation about the 64 bills that Governor Walker signed into law. Do you have any thoughts on the new legislation Governor Walker passed this week? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. J.R., let's start with the controversial legislation, the Assembly Bill 128, changing abortion coverage for public employees. Can you break down the contents of that bill for us and what it does?
Essentially, it prohibits the group insurance board. This is kind of the state board that does contracts for health coverage and that kind of stuff for public employees. They cannot sign a contract for a health plan that pays for abortions, with the only exceptions being rape, incest, or life of the mother. What's interesting is this bill in some ways is a consolation prize for those who oppose abortion rights in Wisconsin. If you think about this legislative session, there are two other bills that came up that were a little more controversial. And one is the effort that Republicans have undertaken for a couple sessions now to try and ban the sale of fetal tissue, right? This goes back to those Planned Parenthood videos that really got anti-abortion folks up in arms. That bill never made it to the floor. Neither did a proposal that would prohibit the teaching of abortion, basically at UW-Madison. Those two bills are things that the anti-abortion movement really wanted as well, but they never got to the point where they were going to pass. This bill, something they wanted, but it wasn't the big prize for some of those folks that they're looking for this session.
So with this additional restriction to abortion coverage, does it change anything in practice? In other words, is this a marginal change or a pretty big change for some?
It's, if you're a public employee, it's definitely a change for you. If you're a state worker, this is not going to be in your health plan anymore. The argument from those who back it is we shouldn't be using taxpayer dollars to pay for abortions, and there's subsidies for this health coverage, and therefore you shouldn't be doing this. But as far as, like, the average person walking the street in Wisconsin, no, you're not going to see a change. But, again, public employees, they will be affected.
How have we seen pro-choice and pro-life advocates reacting to this Assembly Bill 128?
The anti-abortion folks really herald this bill as, you know, another kind of notch in their wins they've had under Republican leadership. Those who support abortion rights obviously have opposed this, and this is an unnecessary burden on people and restricting access to health care. But this was something that for most Republicans was something that they considered kind of part of their orthodoxy that they very much supported.
Will we see this bill in ads, do you think, on the campaign trail headed toward November?
My guess would be not simply an explanation of restricting abortion coverage for public employees, but you will see a part of an overall argument, I'm sure, of restricting access to health care for women in certain races. Now, if you look at Wisconsin, the map in general, there are places that this would play better than others. So I'm not sure you'll see it like a statewide ad against Governor Walker, for example, mentioning this bill, but you might see some targeted mail, radio, digital ads talking about Governor Walker and access to health care, especially because the Republican Party nationally has been hemorrhaging suburban women in races across the country. We saw it in Alabama in the U.S. Senate race there. We saw it in Virginia in November in the legislative races there. We saw it in the 10th Senate District up in Wisconsin, western Wisconsin, back in January. This is one of those issues that will not help the Republican Party if used effectively when it comes to that demographic of voters.
We're getting briefed on some of the 64 bills that Governor Walker signed into law this week with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Join in with your questions on the laws, the bills that you followed, 800-642-1234. Do you see positive or negative consequences in any piece of the new legislation Governor Walker signed into law this week? Do you agree or disagree with the new restrictions on abortion insurance coverage for public employees? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Governor Walker's office said the 64 bills will improve access to child care, will create a transitional program at the Department of Workforce Development for veterans, increase funding for watershed protection grants. We're sifting through some of the bills that became law with J.R. Ross. He's editor at WisPolitics.com, gathering your questions, your reflections on the legislation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the new law that allows minors to receive emergency mental health care without parental consent? How about changes to civil asset forfeiture? The new law would allow money or property to be seized from only people convicted of a crime. Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. JR, let's turn to this bill that looks at how Wisconsin approaches international policy. It's a bill that basically outlaws the state government from engaging in any kind of boycott of Israel. Phil in Ridgeway has a question on this bill. Phil, go ahead.
Yes, I understand that there are deep and historic reasons for some of the actions that we as a nation have taken with and contrary to Israel. I want to put those aside for a minute and just look at the transparent issue here, and that is boycotting a state agency or a local government boycotting Israel isn't the issue, really. For me, it's as a nation of Israel, it's the issue of pointing out Israel as an exception. What influence does Israel have that gives them that honored privilege to coerce governments or state agencies from any other country? And I just would like to ask your guest to speak to that issue and how the state legislature can justify making that a law.
JR, go ahead.
So I'll get right to base politics about this issue. State Senator Leah Vukmir is running for U.S. Senate. She is one of the people who pushed this legislation in this session. Typically, if you are running in a Republican primary, you want to be seen as a friend and ally of Israel. This is a way politically for Leah Vukmir to be seen as a friend, ally of Israel. Now, there's also policy here that she supports. Let's not say it's all about politics, but basically what the bill is saying is that the state can't contract, with this being signed, any company that's participating in, we call the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. There is a push out there from some folks that object to the way Israel has been treating Palestinians, and so they're talking about this boycott movement. There is not anybody, I mean, to be honest, I don't know that this is really a big issue or a problem that's been happening. Governor Walker signed an executive order, I think in October of last year, to prohibit companies from contracting state agencies from boycotting Israel. I don't know that there's been any company that I know of that's been doing this work for state government. I think, like, April of 2017, the Associated Students of Madison considered a proposal requesting university to divest from several Israeli companies, but that never made it very far. I think it was later amended to change it. So this is not, like, a big issue or there's any real impact that I see. But politically, there is an opportunity here for, again, Leah Vukman to be seen as a friend and ally of Israel in what could be a very bruising Republican primary to take on Tammy Baldwin this fall.
Jer, have we seen this type of legislation historically?
I think I want to guess off the top of my head around 25, 26 states now have something similar. I've seen that figure before, so we are not unique in this. We're not groundbreaking here with this proposal.
Phil, thanks so much for the call. Jer, let's talk about another healthcare bill that Governor Walker signed, one that allows minors to receive outpatient emergency mental health treatment without parental consent. Can you outline this bill for us?
Sure. There has been a big push to address mental health in Wisconsin, period. That's one thing that's been kind of a cause for the last year with Republicans. So I'm trying to find that in my list. This bill was supported by really a spectrum of people involved with education, social workers, nurses, psychiatrists. It waives a requirement for informed consent for outpatient mental health treatment for minors in emergency situations. And that's one of the keys. In emergency situations, talking about people who are having an issue, need to be addressed right away. It allows them to get treatment immediately rather than seeking this consent, and so trying to speed things up.
So where did the motivation to pass it come from? Is this something that was pushed by the people in healthcare?
One of the lawmakers who backed it, Amy Loudenbeck, a Republican from Clinton, she had pushed it because there was concerns that she heard from the Beloit School District about the inability of unaccompanied youth to access mental health services. So because of that, and if you're in need, you're in need, was the idea. Mm. So let's speed this up and get them treatment now rather than waiting for that consent and have the situation potentially be exacerbated.
Well, let's get into this Assembly Bill 836, which raises the population threshold to be considered a populous county from 500,000 or more residents to 750,000 or more residents. Seems a bit like a tedious policy change. What's going on there?
This issue is sexy. Are you kidding me?
All right. I'm listening now.
No, I'm just kidding. So when you write state laws, you can't single out a community. So you can't say this law only applies to Milwaukee County. So what you do if you're writing a law that only pertains to Milwaukee County is you say a county of X population is only impacted by this law. Well, Dane County has been growing leaps and bounds population-wise, and it is bumping up against the threshold. In fact, I think it's going to pass the threshold, which had been 500,000, to qualify for these unique standards. And obviously, Milwaukee is a unique community in Wisconsin, our biggest metropolitan area, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of things that apply to Milwaukee that they never intended to apply to Dane County. Without this change, Dane County would have been hit with a whole slew of new requirements that were intended for Milwaukee County. By making this change, it takes threshold from 500,000 people to 750,000 people, which means Dane County will not be hit by these requirements, at least for the next decade, or we'll see how the population growth goes.
I wonder what's going on there, because perhaps it would make sense for some of these laws to be applied to Dane County, considering the growing population.
Local officials in Dane County did not want to have these things apply to them. They were not interested, and they got no blowback from Republicans about it. It was passed on a voice vote in both houses, and so it saves Dane County from this requirement, at least for now.
So moving on to the conservative group Americans for Prosperity of Wisconsin, praising Governor Walker's new law that reforms civil asset forfeiture procedures. Can you explain what that is and what changes in the law?
Sure. This has become a cause for conservative groups about civil forfeiture. So this is became a big trend in law enforcement for the last, 20 years. That window may be larger or smaller, but basically it's been a movement where police can seize property even when the owner is not charged or even convicted of a crime, but you're a suspect, all right? The burden then falls on the owner to prove the belongings are not criminally tainted. It also allowed the authorities to grab kind of cast a wide net in what they seize. This bill would alter some fundamentals of the asset forfeiture practice. For example, the forfeiture has to be tied to a criminal conviction. Also, the forfeiture has to be proportional to the offense. So you couldn't grab everything. So if the truck was used in the crime, you can't grab the house, too, just because. There'd have to be some kind of tie to the crime, if that makes sense. This has been a big cause for conservatives and libertarians. I went back and looked. There were several law enforcement groups opposed to the bill, but the state bar supported it. AFP pushed it. Some of the conservative groups were behind it. So this is something that Dave Craig is a Republican from the town of Vernon. He's been pushing this for a while.
Do you think this will do anything to help potential problems with civil asset forfeiture, such as law enforcement's conflict of interest there?
That is exactly what's targeted at. The backers of this movement believe there is an incentive for law enforcement to seize everything that they can. Police will argue that that's a good thing, that when you have a drug operation, for example, it taints, if you want to use that word, every bit of your being. So there should be able to grab all these things, but it's become something where some people think there are abuses going on. This will rein that in.
Okay, so moving on, Governor Walker passed a bill that will change when schools or school districts have to publish their accountability reports in order to give the Department of Public Instruction adequate time to evaluate them. What was the DPI having trouble with this?
It just, like the Wisconsin Association of School Boards had praised this move, it just said that it would be a more realistic timeline for DPI in making this assessment, because it moves the date from October 15th to November 30th when it has to be done. I mean, that doesn't seem like much time, but it's just additional days to make the decision of when a school is eligible to be placed in this, we call it the Opportunity Schools and Partnership Program. That's where they get to, you know, these kind of turnaround programs that the state kind of steps in for things. It's just more time for the schools to do this. Also pushes back publishing the annual school accountability report to November 30th rather than September. Again, more time for DPI to do some things and publish this information.
Seems like a small tweak. Did you see a trend of smaller tweaks in these 64 bills or not?
You know, this session was interesting overall, and I mean, not just these 64 bills, but the session was interesting overall in that Republicans have been in charge of Madison, you know, both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, pretty much for 7 years and 2 or 3 months. The one exception was a 6-month period, roughly, after the 2012 recall elections when they lost the Senate, but they're already out of session, so it didn't really impact a whole lot. So in that time, Republicans knocked off just a slew of the to-do things for conservatives. You know, like we remember the Act 10 fights, restricting abortion after 20 weeks. I mean, you can go on down the list of like these conservative to-do list, and they've knocked them out. This session was really marked by much more parochial fights about smaller issues because they've done so much. They've, you know, in their words, you know, done tort reform, those kinds of things. Now they're fighting over smaller things. So it was really kind of an interesting session, and from that perspective of the infighting among Republicans, especially with the budget, which dragged on until mid-September, and seeing kind of less big-ticket bills being pushed. They've done, you know, they include a bunch of big things in the budget, like prevailing wage, right to work. You know, so this session was more parochial in general, I think.
Well, J.R., thanks for making time for us.
Oh, anytime.
J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com. He served as a guide today on some of the 64 bills that Governor Walker signed on Election Day. You can find a link to the list of laws on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. Now, this election season, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking people what issues are important to them, and we're meeting them where they are, out in the community. As Bridget Bowden reports, some voters are concerned about how agriculture affects the safety of the drinking water that comes out of their wells.
There are about 900,000 private wells in Wisconsin. People rely on the water for drinking, cooking, and bathing. And some of them are worried, like Chris Bersian, who lives in Broadhead. He says he worries about his well getting contaminated with bacteria from manure from nearby farms.
The thought of that leaching into the groundwater and, you know, poisoning our well is kind of scary.
There are a few ways that this could happen. Manure is often stored in large lagoons or spread over farm fields as fertilizer. Depending on the depth of the soil and the time of year, it can potentially leach down into the groundwater.
Yeah, it has the potential to really hurt. If our well gets contaminated, then what are we going to do?
He's worried that he may one day have to buy water for his family to use.
But not only that, but it will ruin the property value. It's just kind of a bad situation all the way around.
Some people, like Bercian, are worried about very large farms. Farms with more than 1,000 animal units have to have permits to operate in the state. They're known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Becky Larson is a professor of biological systems engineering at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. She says the biggest misconception is that only large farms are dangerous for drinking water.
Personally, I think I disagree with that message and that it is not a size that is to blame, it's a management practice.
She says one of the best things people can do is pay attention to what their local governments are doing.
If a farm is large for a permitting process, there are public hearings that go on that you can attend to voice your concerns. Past that, it is difficult to influence whether or not a farm can locate in a certain area.
Larson says some parts of the state are especially vulnerable to well contamination, like some parts of eastern Wisconsin in areas where the soil is very shallow. In January, the State Department of Natural Resources approved restrictions on manure spreading in 15 counties in eastern Wisconsin. The plan needs to be approved by Governor Walker and then will head to lawmakers. Larson says people who are worried about their own water should go to public meetings and voice their concerns.
So people's concerns are very valid, and anything concerning your own resources and your land and where you live and your health is absolutely of a concern.
Janet McConaughey is worried about the 6 dairy and beef CAFOs in Jefferson County where she lives. So she started volunteering, testing water in the area. And then she went one step further. She decided to run for office for a spot on the town board in Ixonia.
My representative on the county board said, well, why don't you just run? So only takes 20 signatures to get on the ballot. And here I am.
She says she ran with her 5-year-old grandson in mind.
What I'm concerned about is Jordan's world. So I want to know that when he's grown up, he'll have a decent place to live. He'll have clean air, clean water.
In the end, McConaughey lost her race for town board. Both seats were won by incumbents. But she says she'll continue to do everything she can to protect the groundwater in her town. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can find more stories like this one. Visit WPR.org/ballot to share your own story. You can call our hotline at 877-782-8942. That hotline number, once again, is 877-782-8942. Coming up after the news, we'll continue our look at a bill by the governor that issues more funding for a program that tries to protect the watershed. Are you part of the producer-led watershed protection grant program here in Wisconsin? What is your role? What does this program mean for Wisconsin? We'll look at bills that are impacting the ag sector. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. A news update is coming up next. Governor Walker signed 64 bills into law Tuesday, including several that impact Wisconsin's agricultural sector. We're talking about these high-profile ag-related bills here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's bring in Paul Mitchell. He directs the Rank Agribusiness Institute at UW-Madison. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
So Governor Walker signed a bill increasing funding for producer-led watershed grant programs. What do these programs do?
Mostly they're to facilitate the development of farmer-led groups to work with themselves to increase adoption of practices among the farmers that improve water quality in the state.
And so what are the goals of the program? What are they trying to do here in the state?
Well, the big picture is they're trying to improve water quality, and the way they're doing it is through improving adoption of practices that we know do so by the farmers in their watersheds. The farmers pick the practices they want to trial. They trial them out. They collect information to see what impacts they're having on that stream or that lake in their area.
And then what do the grants fund?
Mostly they're thought of as like cost share. The farmers lead the group in helping figure out what they want to spend the money on, but they're required to do a 50% cost share, so the farmers contribute some of their time and effort as well as there's income from other groups, funding. It's things like soil testing, the cost to plant a cover crop, the cost to do a nutrient or manure management planning. They also do a lot of experimentation on developing different ways to apply manure, things like buffer strips, grass waterways, things like that. They're any kind of thing. They're trying to be innovative where the farmers take control of the watershed problems themselves and try to come up with solutions.
How popular are these grants and how competitive are they?
Well, they've grown tremendously. Originally, the funding was for $250,000 a year, and after a couple of years, it quickly hit that limit. Last year, they had to call in November for proposals, and they had $619,000 worth of requests for funding. They only had $250,000.
So this bill ups the amount of money that's available for grants?
Yes, but the overall limit for a group is still very small. At the most, it's $40,000 plus whatever they can, their 50% cost share, or matching, I guess I should call it. So these are small shops, if you will, and so they're not huge operations. They're not big funding. There's lots of little groups and lots of little watersheds around the state.
So the law provides one-time funding of $500,000, $500,000 in fiscal years 2018 and 2019 for these grants. Can you give us a sense of what that could mean, that what that money could do in Wisconsin and what projects might be impacted?
Well, what they do is they add that to the $250,000, and so that's $750,000 a year for this year and next year. And they're hoping to fund some of those projects they received in November to get some of those projects rolling. But it's going to basically, in some of these watersheds, some of the famous ones are Yahara Pride, Peninsula Pride, there's various ones, Cedar Creek, and different places. The growers in this area get together and do what they can, leading it themselves and doing lots of on-farm research and field days to get their neighbors to see it. So it's kind of a facilitate the facilitators to help themselves improve. And it's very much focused on water quality. That's the lead of it. So they're looking at all these traditional agricultural practices that we know have positive impacts, trying to find ways to make them work on their farms in the specifics of their farms and the specific of their watershed. And farmers know those areas better than anyone else.
We're talking right now with Paul Mitchell. He directs the Rank Agribusiness Institute at UW-Madison. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you part of the producer-led watershed protection grant program here in Wisconsin? What is your role? What does the program mean for the state? And what do you think of a law that adds to the requirements to animal draw vehicles? Is this needed for public safety? Why or why not? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Paul, is it difficult to find the matching money for this grant program?
Not so much. I mean, yes and no. It's not, money isn't free, obviously. And so there's always, you're finding someone, there's partner organizations out there that are looking for people to work with. The Nature Conservancy was a supporter of the bill. The Wisconsin, I got to get these right, the full list. The Wisconsin River Alliance, I believe. Here, I'm getting the list. Nature Conservancy, the Wisconsin chapter, the River Alliance of Wisconsin, the Sierra Club, John Muir chapter, Wisconsin Association for Lakes, and then there's several agricultural organizations. This is a program that a lot of organizations are behind. It doesn't fall under the traditional splits we see in divisions and politically. Everyone sees this as a good idea. So you've got ag groups, you've got environmental groups willing to fund this in different ways.
Do the matching dollars usually come from the public or private sector, or is it a mix?
It's a mix, and most of it, I don't know the specifics of the administration, but I don't think you can match it with, like, federal cost share from the Natural Resource Conservation Service of the USDA or state money. It has to come from private or, various foundations or nonprofit organizations as well.
Do you see this dollar amount as enough, or do you think that this law should be putting in more for this program?
I think right now it's working the way it is with these smaller amounts of money. You make it bigger, it's going to change the character of the whole program. Mm. It's really meant to be farmers talking to farmers about the stuff they're doing on their farms, and trying to create that multiplier effect with some farmers in one area using this money to monitor what's going on the edge of their fields, given what they're doing on those fields, and then talking to their neighbors about it.
Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Stoughton. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning. A quick question. I know in Ohio they have a nutrient credit trading program where farmers get a little bit of money for each pound of nutrient reduced. Wisconsin does not have that program, but it would allow the farmers who are investing money in these nutrient and water quality programs to, you know, maybe recoup something. Any thoughts about getting Wisconsin to do something like that?
Do you see any momentum in that area on a nutrient credit trading program?
I haven't heard people talking about wanting to do that here, but, you know, it's not like I don't talk to everybody. There's tons of people working on these issues. And it wouldn't surprise me if people are talking about it. I think from some farmers' perspective, it's just another, we'll call it a bureaucratic program. They're looking for something a little more that they're in charge of. And, the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service offers funding and cost share for doing different things, and a lot of farmers don't want to participate because of the paperwork, the bureaucratic nature of the program. Some of these are just people that are happy to do these things would like a little help, but not a lot. So I'm not saying this program, nutrient trading, it's a good idea for some people. It's not a good idea for other people, and that's this program, the Farmer-Led Watershed Program. Some people want that. Other people would want something different.
Let's bring in Loretta now in Dodge County. Good morning, Loretta.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I work with UW Extension and actually have one of the producer-led grants with the group of farmers. It's really been an amazing experience for me to work with these amazing producers that are very engaged in soil health. And our group is the Dodge County Farmers for Healthy Soil and Healthy Water. And they've been doing a lot with cover cropping and holding a lot of educational programs. So part of the grant is to do a lot of on-farm trials that I've been helping them set up and put out educational programs, and they've been taking the lead, doing an amazing, incredible work.
Loretta, thanks so much for the call. Paul, any follow-up on that?
I should have brought that up sooner, yes. They always partner and collaborate with other people, and UW Extension is a big one, obviously. There's other groups out there, the Land and Water Conservation Districts in their area and stuff like that. A lot of times they're asking for technical assistance, and UW Extension, I actually work for Extension as well. They're well-placed to be in these regions, in these counties, ready to help people if they're willing to work with them. Some of these farmer-led watershed groups work with the university in Extension or some other official public groups. Other ones do not, and it's up to the group. You let the farmers decide. That's part of the farmer-led component.
Loretta, thanks. Paul, let's turn to this new requirement for animal-drawn vehicles that they must have rear flashing yellow or amber strobe lights. Can you talk us through this bill?
Yeah, essentially, I mean, people, you see this in the news if you're at all aware of it. There seems to be accidents where somebody runs into one of these horse-drawn vehicles. Usually they're horse-drawn Amish or some other group like that. And, I mean, you look at the data, there's over 30 accidents a year, 1 to 5 fatalities. People are injured and for life, some of them, or people are killed. What they're doing is adjusting the rules slightly on these to make sure there's flashing lights in the back so that when you're driving at night, sometimes people get fixated on this constant red light that's currently the requirement, and they've moved towards this flashing light that causes people to slow down instead of fixate on the solid red light as a guide. This is very similar to laws that are used in Pennsylvania and Indiana, where there's several of these groups as well, horse-drawn vehicles being in use. And it seems to have worked.
Are there challenges when changing requirements and adding technology to animal-drawn vehicles?
Yeah, I'm not up to speed on all the requirements and or how Amish people feel about this. I know there some groups are willing to ride in vehicles if other people drive. I don't know how they deal with the flashing lights. I'm assuming they're electric. My understanding is a lot of these homes don't have electricity in them as it is, and so I don't quite understand that aspect. But I think everyone agrees that it's these accidents and these deaths are something we should be doing something about, and that's what this is meant to do.
Well, Paul, thanks for making time for us.
You're welcome.
Paul Mitchell directs the Rank Agribusiness Institute at UW-Madison. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, and Keely Boltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.